Beyonce and Jay-Z have a new album out. We're going to talk about that. Oh, also trade and foreign investment as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 18th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the once and future prospects of the government agency that's come to represent the political divide over how best to protect consumers in this post-financial crisis economy. After various rumors and leaks this weekend, the White House has confirmed the president will nominate Kathy Kraninger, an associate director in the Office of Management and Budget, to replace Mick Mulvaney as the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Mulvaney has been vocal here and elsewhere about his desire to restructure the CFPB and limit its impact. So Marketplace's Aaron Schrank gets us going with where things might go now.
Since Mick Mulvaney stepped in as interim head 6 months ago, there have been structural changes that seem to shift the agency's focus away from consumer protection under Dodd-Frank regulations. Ben Olson is a former deputy assistant director at the Bureau.
He's also emphasized other parts of the Dodd-Frank Act, which require the Bureau to make sure that markets operate efficiently, to provide clear guidance to the industry. So the tone seems to be the biggest change so far.
Other changes also worry consumer advocates. Mulvaney wants to reorganize the offices of fair lending and student lending, essentially rolling back their enforcement powers. Since he took office, the CFPB has issued just 2 enforcement actions.
All of these are indicative that the Bureau's moving away from the well-being of families toward the single-minded mission of deregulation.
Ann Bedore was chair of the agency's Independent Consumer Advisory Board until it was disbanded this month. The law requires that group to exist, so CFPB leadership will have to reform it with new members.
I can't help but wonder if what they'd want is a group that will rubber stamp any initiative that the Bureau puts forward under this new leadership.
CFPB funding is set by law at a fixed percentage of the Federal Reserve's operating budget. Diane Katz at the Heritage Foundation says reorganizing the agency won't change that fact.
The real problem is that Congress has no control over this agency.
Mulvaney cut $200 million out of the CFPB budget this year and plans to reduce next year's budget by 20%. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
We're going to do a markets story right now, not how the markets are going right now, but the way the markets think things are going to go at some defined point in the future, given the trade unease of late. Those kinds of markets that we're talking about are called, cleverly, the futures markets. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more on what they can tell us.
A future is a contract you sign now to buy or sell something in the future. Wheat, steel, pork, could be anything.
A futures contract allows someone to lock in a price today for something they're going to sell in the future.
Blue Putnam is chief economist of CME Group, which runs some of the world's most important futures markets.
Futures markets are not particularly accurate at predicting the future, but they do represent a barometer of how people are thinking today.
And people are thinking that our trade disputes with other countries are going to hurt a lot of U.S. agricultural producers. Scott Irwin chairs agricultural marketing at the University of Illinois.
In the last few weeks, soybean prices have declined over 10%.
That's because of planned Chinese retaliatory tariffs on soybeans. Similar things happening with cotton futures. Jack Scoville is vice president of Price Futures Group.
Another market that most people don't think about is the frozen concentrated orange juice market.
The EU is preparing retaliatory tariffs on, among other things, frozen concentrated orange juice. So futures prices went down there. On the other hand,
natural gas futures have increased in value.
Larry McDonald is founder of the Bear Traps Report, a risk analysis newsletter. If the U.S. and China reach a deal where China buys more natural gas, then maybe the price of natural gas will rise in the future.
Markets, I think, believe there's a grand bargain in the end.
A grand bargain to resolve the U.S.'s many trade disputes. Then again, maybe not in time for U.S. farmers. Then again, maybe markets are just scratching their heads like the rest of us. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Yeah, go with that second then again. Because on Wall Street today, it was just like Friday. Down a lot and then down less. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a lot about the current level of disarray in the global trading economy that's a bit confusing, right? Which country has tariffs on what, who gets exempted, and what is it all going to mean? Luckily for us, we've got a series designed for exactly this situation. Your questions, our answers, a little thing we call I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Today's question comes from Richard Cole. He's in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and here it is. Please provide a clear and precise definition of the term trade war. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is now, and maybe forever, on the trade beat.
I get Richard's frustration. There's actually a pretty good reason for it.
There's no official definition of what a trade war is.
Doug Irwin is a trade historian at Dartmouth College.
It's not even really an official term that's used by economists or others.
It's a term people use to describe the back and forth between countries trying to restrict each other's trade. So one country imposes, say, tariffs or quotas, some kind of barrier to restrict imports, and then the affected country responds with their own restrictions.
And then you get into the cycle of one country imposing barriers, the other country retaliating, and it sort of spins out of control.
Irwin says the U.S. hasn't been in a full-blown trade war since the 1930s. And deciding if we're in one now, it's a bit subjective. Yes, the U.S. has imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, and some of our trading partners have threatened to retaliate on July 1st. Separately, the Trump administration will impose tariffs on some imports from China starting July 6th, and likewise, the Chinese are threatening to levy their own tariffs the same day. Does that mean we're in a trade war now?
We are not in a state of war, but we are not in a state of peace.
Susan Aronson is a professor at George Washington University.
The United States has fired the first weapons in this dispute, and other countries are very, very upset by it.
Aronson says right now countries are just threatening to retaliate. They've announced tariffs, but those tariffs aren't yet in place. If those threatened tariffs become reality, that's what would tip this into a trade war. So right now, we're on the brink, but not quite there yet.
When another country or countries start to retaliate, that's when the effects can spread throughout the economy and globally. So I'm very worried about this situation.
Doug Irwin is likewise concerned, but thinks we're a bit further from a war. He says in the context of all the goods traded around the world, the amount covered by these tariffs is still relatively small.
I'd call it trade spat, maybe, about certain products. Some people said it's a trade tiff or a trade tussle, but it's just confined to a few products at the moment.
So even if other countries put their own tariffs in place, as long as they respond proportionally and don't escalate, in his mind, it still won't rise to the level of a trade war.
It's not sort of this across-the-board severe reduction in world trade.
But if the Trump administration goes further and imposes tariffs on imported cars, something it's investigating but hasn't yet announced.
And then they extend it to other products, and it gradually creeps along to include many, many different imported commodities. And other countries continue to retaliate. I think that would constitute an escalation where the word trade war would be more appropriate.
For Irwin, there's this extra ingredient needed to make a trade war, scale. It's not just the back and forth between countries, it's the amount of trade affected. So while it might feel like we're in a trade war, most economists would say not yet. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We're going to dip back into an every now and then series we do now that is predicated on this idea that the economic headlines aren't really much good unless you know how people are feeling in their own individual economies. We call it My Economy, and today's installment comes from this headline, that the number of homeless people in Los Angeles County is down 3% from last year. Here's one of those stories of My Economy.
My name is Charlene Long, and I'm a barista at Rosebud Coffee. I started 2 weeks after they opened, and how I heard about Rosebud was through a transitional housing program. At the time, I was living out of my car. Thank God I had my car, and I was working at Panda Express. I wasn't really making much. You know, I was homeless, and I still needed money. for gas, and so I would panhandle and I would beg and I would cry to these people, like, hey, I need gas, I know I have a job but I don't get paid until this, and you know, everything was just all out of whack. To be honest, for whatever reason, I always had money, you know, and it's like, how can a homeless person have money? But I still have a job. I still had a job at the time, although I was in between just picking up hours here, working there. And when I get paid, I would get like $250, maybe three, and I'll just like put it under my mat in my car. Like, I like what I do. I like, you know, satisfying the people and the customers. But no, I never thought I'd be here. And here I am knowing how to make cortados, espressos, macchiatos. I didn't even know what a macchiato was last year, you know, and it's crazy. I'm renting a room in L.A., and it's, you know, I have my own bathroom, my own backyard where I just go, and I have my dog. So I'm thankful, and sometimes I step out for a quick little cigarette, and I'll be like, wow, like, I never thought that I'll be in my own backyard right now, you know? And it's like, a year ago I was homeless and my birthday passed this year, and I thought about that and it's just like, wow, I came so far compared to where I was last year, and I was just last year. It wasn't that far away, you know?
That was Charlene Long. She's right here in Los Angeles. You can read a transcript of her story and others in the series at marketplace.org. And while you're there, seeing as how this series only works with your help, tell us about your economy. Coming up.
Beyoncé and Jay-Z are so brilliant for using their art to just say so many things, especially now.
Bay and Jay and their new album. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 0.4% today, 103 points, 24,987. Then S&P 500 down 0.2%, about 5 points, 27.73. The NASDAQ basically flat, 77.47. Energy stocks rose ahead of a key OPEC meeting later this week. Member countries will discuss oil production levels. ConocoPhillips ticked up about 1.9%. Chevron rose 1.5%. ExxonMobil gained about 0.2%. More on oil now. Regulators in Minnesota today started hearing final arguments on whether they should approve a new oil pipeline. Calgary-based Enbridge wants to replace a creaky line to carry crude from Canada through northern Minnesota. Enbridge shares up about 0.8%. Crude oil, by the way, West Texas Intermediate, the U.S. benchmark, up 2.25%, $65.83 a barrel. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is able to do what we do every day thanks to funding from public radio stations, foundations, corporate underwriters, and listeners like you. Thank you to all the Marketplace investors who've contributed over the last year for helping keep public service journalism strong. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The media through line the past, what, 5 years now, maybe longer? Don't know. Has been streaming and reaching consumers where they are and the all-encompassing digital future, right? Well, if that's the case, then riddle me this. Now that a federal judge has decided it's okay for AT&T to buy Time Warner, another legacy media company has become the object of much desire. A day after the AT&T ruling, Comcast offered $65 billion for the entertainment assets of 21st Century Fox. Disney's bid for those same assets is $52.5 billion or so, two legacy media companies bidding for a third. So in this age of Netflix and streaming, what is going on here that makes Fox so special? Marketplace's Rima Kreis is on that one.
Some assets are off the table, like Fox News and Fox Sports. But the deal does include... Okay, well, not just The Simpsons. Fox is also home to shows like Empire, Family Guy, and Atlanta. Also to blockbuster franchises like X-Men and Avatar.
Worth it. Totally worth it.
Comcast, which already owns NBC Universal and Disney, also seem to think it's worth it. Paul Verna is a media analyst with eMarketer.
A lot of it does have to do with being more future-proof, having more and better content.
Verna says acquiring Fox isn't just a play to get more cable subscribers. It's about pushing that content onto future streaming platforms. Plus a big prize.
Whichever company wins this battle is going to own the controlling rights to Hulu, which by our estimates made $2 billion last year just in subscription fees and another $1 billion in advertising.
Rebecca Lieb is a media analyst with Kaleido Insights. She says beyond shows and movies, the theme parks matter.
Commercializing really licensed characters and licensed entertainment.
And then there's the international side. Fox already has a stake in the European satellite provider Sky, and there's room to grow, says Eric Brannon, an analyst with IHS Market.
We are not forecasting tremendous cord-cutting internationally like we are domestically.
So the Fox chase is on, with Comcast and Disney determined to dominate ever more content. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
According to the Department of Commerce, the United States attracted nearly $4 trillion in foreign investment in 2016. That's the latest year we've got data for. 2016 is also, and this matters, before President Trump took office and brought with him a cooling of some of America's key global economic relationships. That's the long way around to set up this next story. The fifth annual Select USA Investment Summit gets going this week, Wednesday, in suburban Maryland. It's co-sponsored by the Commerce Department. Thousands of current and potential foreign investors are going to spend 3 days being pitched by states and cities looking to get their money. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganzer takes a look at the state of international investment matchmaking in the age of Trump.
For years, Fairfax County, Virginia has pretty much sold itself. Low taxes, great schools, commuting distance from Capitol Hill and the Pentagon. But this year, Fairfax isn't leaving anything to chance. It's lined up a cushy motor coach, okay, bus, to ferry international investors around the county for 3.5 hours the day before the summit starts. Gerald Gordon, head of Fairfax's Economic Development Authority, gives me an abbreviated version of the tour and his spiel.
10 Fortune 500 headquarter operations, an extraordinary workforce for information technology and other technologies.
We pass the corporate headquarters of Intelstat and Volkswagen North America. Gordon points out there are two airports nearby, one international. And he says the county is diverse, with about 48%.
People from outside the United States, different ethnicities, different national origins.
And if your company is worried about getting hit with an unexpected tariff or quota, Gordon says, U.S. business groups are lobbying Congress hard. And eventually, he promises, Congress will rein Trump in. It's all good.
I think these companies are resigned to going through whatever they need to get through in order to be in the United States. So they'll deal with it. They'd rather not, but they will.
Some of the foreign investors I've talked to do feel that way. Andre Kudelski heads the Kudelski Group, a Swiss cybersecurity firm with offices all over the U.S., including a big office in Phoenix that opened recently. I asked Kudelski, if he knew then what he knows now, would he have expanded? Kudelski says what matters to him is the health of the U.S. economy.
The main driver for our expansion is how the U.S. economy is performing.
Okay, that's a yes. Kudelski will be at the investment summit. So will Jonas Swartau, CEO of the Dutch company Newcold. It's building a $90 million highly automated cold food storage facility in Idaho.
So we're developing one of the most advanced cold storages you can imagine.
Storage used by U.S. food processors who export their products. Swartau is worried about what's happening with trade.
As far as they sell their goods outside of the USA and their business is impacted by the NAFTA discussions or potential trade wars, of course, we may be impacted by that.
But would he do it all again if he knew then what he knows now?
Yes, we would do that. Yep.
Eric Chung doesn't share that enthusiasm. Chung is in marketing at POSCO, a South Korean steelmaker with plants in Alabama and Indiana. POSCO imports steel from South Korea and processes it for U.S. manufacturers who turn it into car parts. But POSCO is facing quotas and tariffs, and the new Indiana plant is already running way below capacity. In fact, it's losing around $200,000 a month. Chung says POSCO's management would not do it all again.
The management definitely would not go for putting this investment here if they knew about what's happening right now.
Chung says he might still go to the Select USA Summit to make contacts, not scout for deals. At this point, foreign steel is a non-starter. Jan Rogers is CEO for Regional Economic Development for Eastern Idaho. She'll be looking for investors in tech and certain types of agriculture. She says she's not that worried about trade yet.
I don't know that it keeps me up at night, but it's on the radar for sure.
And Rogers thinks she may have discovered a way to turn the tariffs to her advantage by reminding international investors, if you make it and sell it in the United States, you don't pay a tariff. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There was a seismic happening in the pop culture and music worlds this weekend, aka Beyoncé did something. She dropped a new album pretty much out of nowhere with her husband Jay-Z. It's their first joint album. It's called Everything Is Love. The viral thing about it, though, is the video for one of the songs, Ape Bleep is the title. I can't say it on the radio, but here is a little bit of it. What you need to know is that they did it in the Louvre in Paris, surrounded by a whole lot of classical art, I guess you'd say. We called up Danielle Young to talk about it. She writes and produces at The Root. We had her on a couple of months ago, you might remember, after Beyoncé made her Coachella debut. Danielle, good to talk to you again.
Great to be spoken to, especially when it comes to Beyoncé.
Well, as we learned last time. Look, let me get your quick off-the-cut reactions. I want to talk specifically about the video. Not the album itself, but the video first. Holy cow, that was cool, I thought.
Man, listen, Beyoncé and Jay-Z have this just innate ability to just stop us cold, stop the world cold. Just to see it in the Louvre and to see these different shades of beautiful blackness, and even in the different shades of nude ballerina gear, it was just like, wow, like Beyoncé and Jay-Z are so brilliant for using their art to just say so many things, especially now when we need the affirmations as black people that, you know, our lives do matter and we have this chance to actually live and experience art. And it's aspirational. And I really hope people are gravitating towards culture and things like that.
To the marketplace slice of this thing, it's their first joint album. It dropped unusually in the middle of a tour. I mean, there's a whole bunch of, no, you don't do this in the music business, that once again, Beyoncé is saying, I can do anything I want.
Absolutely anything she wants to do. And to have Jay-Z in tow, it's like, you know, reminiscent of the best of both worlds and having two artists who are incredible come together to prove that it doesn't matter what rules are. Like, I will drop an album in the middle of a tour and you will know the songs by tomorrow. Like, people are likely going to be singing along when they first perform these songs as a part of the On the Run tour. On the Run 2 tour. Right. That's a tongue twister.
I don't want to mix my artistic metaphors here, but so I saw, but roll with me on this one. I saw Incredibles 2 this weekend. It was very female focused, right? Elastigirl is in the front. And this thing, you mentioned Jay-Z, but he's like an afterthought. This is all Beyoncé. All women. The dancers are all women. It's all about empowering the woman.
Yeah, it is very much a view on womanhood, black womanhood specifically. And what I love about marriage of Jay-Z and Beyoncé is that he's his own star enough that he doesn't have to step in front of her. He knows that Beyoncé is the thing that we are going to gravitate towards, is the thing that we're going to lift up on high. But for them to have this as the Carters and for him to treat his queen in a way that it's like, no, I know it's about women. I know I'm going to step back and let you speak for black women and show men, you know, how to stand there and be there for black women. It's beautiful.
Worth a mention here that they are clearly using their art as some kind of public therapy, right? I mean, they've had issues in their marriage, and there was Lemonade, and then there was his response, and so they're working this out in public.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I love about this, because Beyoncé is not typically known as that type of artist who wants to show, you know, her personal, her vulnerable side. But she's been doing that a lot more over the last couple of years, especially as she's become a mother, and to even do so by even having lyrics in one of the songs, Love Happy. You know, she said he messed up on the stone. So to be that vulnerable and that open, especially for men and women who go through that, it's a beautiful display of forgiveness and love. I just love them. I'm not over it.
Danielle Young, she writes, she produces for TheRoot.com, does a podcast there as well called Judge of Characters. The video, which is kind of amazing, find your favorite art history professor and watch it with him or her, and you'll learn a lot. Danielle, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today. I mentioned Incredibles 2 when I was talking to Danielle Young just a couple of minutes ago. If you haven't seen it yet, here is a little PSA. Theaters are posting signs out front that say this, quote, Incredibles 2 contains a sequence of flashing lights, which may affect customers who are susceptible to photosensitive epilepsy or other photosensitivities. The movie was good. I liked it. But without spoiling anything, you'd have thought they could have come up with a different way to make that same plot point, right? All right, we got to go. Wall Street today down a lot and then down a little bit. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman, although she is directing this week. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.